Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. I'd like to welcome Ryan Schneider to the show. He's the principal of Ryan Schneider & Associates and former vice president of the Los Angeles Transportation Board of Commissioners. And he's given lots of lectures from UCLA Graduate School of Architecture and Urban Planning and all across the world on the issue of bus and rail. So he was an early advisor of the Strategy Center and the strategic direction for the Bus Riders Union leading up to the BRU's 1994 Civil Rights Title VI lawsuit with the MTA. He joins us in studio today. Welcome.
Thanks, Tammy.
So I think I'd like to start, I mean, because one of the major issues around the fare increase is the MTA is saying we've got a budget deficit. And a lot of what we're trying to say, it's a self-imposed budget deficit that looks right at the crux of bus and rail. And the thing about people saying, why not rail? It's great. I was in New York or Chicago, and the rail was great. Why can't we have it in Los Angeles? And what is this always about buses? So we brought you in to try to demystify some of this. And it's not that we're just rail-hating folks out here, but that there's actual real logic behind this. And so, as I said earlier, you were one of the advisors to the Bus Riders Union early on. And as we started the Bus Riders Union work, we actually initially thought it could be multimodal to look at what would transportation planning be in Los Angeles County. And then through working with you and Marty Wax, who was then at UCLA Planning School and was then up at UC Berkeley in charge of the transportation, the Urban Planning School, really helped us to see that the issue of rail is much more complex and doesn't work in Los Angeles. So for all the folks that say, what's wrong with rail? It's beautiful. Why can't we have it in Los Angeles? What would be your two-minute response to them?
It's about applying the right remedy to the right problem. Public transportation is collective transportation. In other words, you need to collect people who are traveling the same direction at the same time along the same corridor. And in Los Angeles, we have the critical mass to fill buses. We don't have the critical mass of people needing to fill trains. A lot of it has to do with the density. We don't have Manhattan-type density, but it also has to do with our land use patterns. We're scattered. We're spread out. The vast majority of our work sites, for example, are along our boulevards. They are not in centers. And rail tends to serve centers better than it does boulevards. And our land use patterns, our travel patterns, are very scattered. If you were to plot our travel patterns, it would look like a plate of spaghetti. And so for public transportation to serve many trips, we need something that's very flexible like buses. Rail is too inflexible and cannot serve the vast majority of those trips.
Okay, so we got to break some of this stuff down for folks. You said the issue of density. Let's talk about that more because there's 10 million people, right, in 4,000 square miles. What's the issue around density?
Well, they're not all coming from the same place and going to the same place along the same corridor. They're going all over the place. They're starting from, you know, wherever. I mean, from Mid-Wilshire and going to Santa Monica, they're going from Culver City to Van Nuys. Our trips are very, very scattered, and in order for us to provide transit that people are able to use, we need to mimic the flexibility that the auto provides. And that means ubiquitous service that goes everywhere. The bus is best capable of providing that type of service.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that I think folks should understand is that there's 650 square miles of freeway, right? And so you're talking about the flexibility needed to be able to use the existing structures.
Think about a typical trip that you make. You don't travel just along one street or corridor. You'll travel up one, you'll turn left, you go down there for a while, you'll turn right, you get on the freeway, you get off, you turn, you know, make a few other turns. And so that we need, again, transit that is able to make that type of trip rather than putting all our marbles into one basket and providing high-quality service along one corridor. We need to provide high-quality service along many corridors.
And so then talk about the land use a little bit more in the sense of you've done actually some research around job sites in Los Angeles County, and what do they add up to be?
Well, the paper that I wrote on this topic, I looked at the largest work centers in the region, and I found that the 19 largest work centers, and that would be, of course, downtown Westwood, Century City, but also Burbank, Glendale, Ontario, Irvine, and some others, comprise about 20% of our region's workforce. And by the way, most of those are not transit-conducive centers. You know, Westwood, Century City, Warner Center, downtown, a few are the kind of place where you can get off transit and walk to your destination. But many of them, for example, Irvine is a very large center. So this means that the majority of our trips, the majority of our work sites aren't in centers. They are along our boulevards. And so we need to focus our transit along those boulevards.
And that's changed a lot because we've gone from a manufacturing-based economy to a service-based economy.
Right. When you think of what happened in the 1980s with all the development, all the new office buildings going up, you can think about Glendale or Burbank or Irvine or Ontario or, you know, Warner Center, all these places that grew tremendously because they no longer had to be tied to a rail line or a river like the old sort of manufacturing cities had to be. Work centers scattered. And so transit has to match that.
So then when MTA says, look, we've got a budget deficit, we need to raise their fares. So I'm not one for always looking at the bottom line. Sometimes to me, it might even cost more, but if it benefits the actual working people and the communities, then I might be advocating for it. But what is the bottom line around transportation? And is it self-inflicted or does MTA, what causes MTA's actual budget?
Well, they've got a certain amount of money to work with, and it's a question of making smart choices with the money that they have. They're spending a large part of their money on the revenue on building rail projects, and it hasn't paid off. For example, when they began the rail investment in the early 80s, there was a lot of talk about what rail would deliver to Los Angeles. It would deliver improved air quality. It would reduce congestion. It would improve, reduce energy consumption and provide trips for many more people. But we began that investment in 1985. 22 years later now, we actually have fewer people on transit today than we did before that $10 billion investment. Moreover, we have about 18% fewer percentage of our trips being made on transit. So that investment hasn't delivered. And instead, had we invested in the bus, we could have much improved bus service. We could run more buses. We could run along more street and more frequently and have a much better quality bus system. So to me, that's a question of how you spend your resources. It's also an issue of who you're trying to serve. I think the primary purpose of public transit is to serve the transit dependent, people who don't have other choices, the low income, disabled, children, seniors, and so forth. And the MTA seems to be very concentrated on trying to get the discretionary rider out of their car. That is important, but at great cost, and I think we can best attract that discretionary rider by providing quality service everywhere.
Mm-hmm. So those discretionary, I mean, like one of the things where environmentalists will often say, and we would agree with wanting to get people out of their cars and onto public transportation, but their main thing is in order to do that, we need to have rail. It's more modern. It's more savvy. So why not build rail and actually try to get people out of the car? Therefore, we have lower emissions.
From the environmental perspective, it really comes down to the number of people that you can attract out of your cars. And again, after this $10 billion investment, 22 years later, we have fewer people on transit today. That theory isn't working out. And why this is not seen as one of the greatest boondoggles in LA County history, doesn't matter if you're on the political left or the political right. It's been a massive waste of money. And it doesn't get people out of their cars the way we could with other investments.
What would be some sound, like if you, so MTA's got, it's a $3 billion agency. It's going to cost how much for the red line to the sea? $5.7 billion to build, and that's just one estimate, right? What could we do with 5.7?
Well, the budget that it would take to build the red line, we'd probably be looking at about $300 to $350 million per year just to pay off the capital cost of that. And that's about 35 or 40% of the entire bus operating budget. So instead of building the red line, we could put that money into the operating budget of the bus. Now, the rail proponents will come back and say, well, this is federal money, some of it, and can't be spent on bus operations. And to some extent, that's true. However, we do have the option of going to the feds and asking for bus money as well. And I think if we came up with a good proposal that they would fund it. When we use federal or state money to build Metro Rail, there's a requirement for a local match. And a lot of that local match comes out of Prop A and Prop C, which could be used on bus operations. So what happens is we cut bus service and raise fares in order to pay for the construction of rail. And it's really been a loser all around, as far as I can tell, because we're losing ridership and we're not serving the people that need the service.
Well, give us a sense of MTA's last project was the Gold Line. What did it cost? What's the current ridership on the Gold Line?
The Gold Line was actually the least successful of all the lines. It was about $860 million, and it's I think it's the ridership is something on the order of 15, maybe 17,000 passengers a day. It's really been very disappointing. The subsidies required for the Gold Line are, I mean, according to my calculations, about $18 per ride. So it's really been a failure. The numbers on the Gold Line are worse than any of the other lines that they've built.
So give us a sense of, well, then what's the subsidy for a bus rider? So if we got $18 on the Gold Line, what would be the subsidy for an
The numbers that I'm working with show about $1.93 subsidy per ride on the bus. Now, I mean, public transit has to be subsidized, and it's a question of where we put our subsidies, and I think the bus is showing that it can subsidize itself for a much lower rate than rail.
You know, something interesting, I was reading in the San Francisco Chronicle. So San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom is asking Muni, which is their municipal transportation authority, to actually look into their current fare is $1.50. So they're asking Muni to actually look into what would it cost to actually not charge a fare, to have free bus service versus collecting fares. So what would that be in terms of a possibility of MTA either going free or reducing the fares and actually increasing what they would get on terms of federal match dollars?
Well, there's a very strong relationship between fare and ridership. For example, in the early 80s when we passed Prop A, the first 3 years of the Prop A revenue coming in, 35% of the money went to subsidize the bus fares so that we dropped bus fares from 85 cents to 50 cents. During that period of time, ridership shot up about 40%, which is really an incredible increase in ridership. Now, when they raised the fare back up to 85 cents, then later $1.10, and later $1.25, ridership went down quite a bit. So there's a real direct relationship between fare and ridership. Now, whether or not we could offer a free service is a question of having the revenue to do it, because we are getting a portion of our revenue to operate the buses from the fare box. So there's a bit of a trade-off there with actually offering free service.
But what about a reduced service?
A reduced fare, I think, would help certainly the rider out, and it would help ridership quite a bit. We would have to make up the revenue somewhere.
And could we match it? Would there be more revenue options in terms of federal dollars to match it if that wasn't, like...
Well, unfortunately, our federal government doesn't do a whole lot with transit operations. It is more willing to fund construction of transit facilities than it is operation, and it's something that was cut back, you know, in recent years and that I'd like to see restored, but not a lot of help from the feds on operating expenses.
Mm-hmm. And so... We're looking at MTA's, over the last 10 years of the consent decree, we've actually seen a ridership initial decline after the fare increase, and then we've seen a peak of 12% ridership. There's a direct correlation also between fares and ridership. And so as at a time where we're trying to entice more people to come on public transportation, what would a fare increase mean in terms of public health, in terms of transportation use?
Well, a fare increase would unquestionably, and we've got the experience to show, ridership would drop. And it would impact, you know, of course, the riders quite a bit. Now, how much it drops depends on how many people just have absolutely no other choice and they have to get somewhere. And in that case, we're just squeezing more and more out of the poor folks who really don't have any more to pay.
Mm-hmm. You know, my coworker, Damon Azali, just came back from a trip, and he was actually visiting France. And he was just telling me in the sense of what urban planning could look like if there was a political desire. And more we're talking about spaces where they're talking about auto-free zones, making it pedestrian-friendly, bike-friendly. And this is not the first city to look at that. Bogota, Colombia has tried to challenge auto-free zones. Mexico City has looked at trying to look at different days of auto-free zones. What would it take in terms of really – we've got – 7 million cars, 8 million cars in a 10 million person county. What would really take to actually force people to get out of the cars and then build the public transportation that's necessary?
Well, I think the first thing we need to look at is dedicating lanes and taking some of that space for transit. For example, on Wilshire Boulevard, instead of building the subway, you dedicate a lane towards the bus. And I could see that same sort of thing being done on other streets as well. I mean, that's one of the first steps. People take their cars because, given the choices in front of them, it's typically the fastest way for them to go from point A to point B if they have that choice. So we need to make other modes of transportation like walking and transit and bicycling more attractive vis-a-vis the auto. So anything we can do to provide more services, but provide an advantage in the form of like a lane.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously the first step, I think. And then we've got to start looking at other ways of sort of challenging the primacy of the automobile. I mean, to me, one of the reasons that the MTA wants to look at spending $5 billion on a subway is because we don't have the political will to take a lane away from traffic on Wilshire Boulevard. Because, you know, just we can't do that to the automobile here, and at great cost. And I think it's a huge mistake. I think we need to start looking at what the car is doing to us. And we've got a massive addiction to the car, and it really undermines so many other community objectives. And, you know, we've put everything on a backseat. Our kids are grown up overweight. A child born today has a 1 in 3 chance of getting diabetes. If you're not white, your chances are 1 out of 2.
Mm.
That's absolutely unacceptable. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we have neighborhoods where kids can't walk to school. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they can't cross busy streets. Seniors are becoming housebound. We've got global warming emissions. I mean, all of these things stem back to our reliance on the automobile and us treating it as though there's nothing we should do to challenge it.
That's a great place to stop. So thank you so much, Ryan Schneider, for joining us. If people wanted to read some of your research, where would they go?
I've posted a few papers on my website, www.rsa.cc.
Okay, again, that's www.rsa.cc.
Yes.
And any number that they can contact you at?
323-571-2910.
And again, that was?
323-571-2910.
Thank you so much, Ryan. We'll take a short break. In our final segment, we'll be talking to Francisco Porches, organizer of the Strategy Center and the Clean Lungs, Clean Buses campaign, and we're going to take a look at how you can get involved.
Thank you.